it was kind of every month getting my period and just being so sad and just weeping, feeling so out of control and broken and like there was something wrong with me and like I'd really massively screwed up waiting this long. It was months and months of this.
Welcome to Gathering Gold, a podcast for highly sensitive souls. I'm Cheryl Paul, a counselor trained in the Jungian depth psychological tradition.
And I'm Victoria Russell, Cheryl's niece and co-host. Today, Cheryl and I are so excited and so happy to have a very special guest. We say this every time, but Sarah Kessner is such a special guest to talk about a topic that is so tender. And we just know that there's no one we trust more with this topic than Sarah. Sarah is a transformational life coach. She was a beloved moderator on Cheryl's online forum for many years, offering so much wisdom and compassion and insight and guidance to so many people around the world. As we go through our conversation today, if you're thinking, oh my gosh, I wish I could talk to Sarah and work with Sarah, you should visit her website or check out her Instagram. You can learn about her coaching services. Her website is sarahkessner.com. That's sarahkessner.com. And her Instagram is at sarahkessnercoach. So today we are talking about fertility anxiety. Again, such a tender topic and one that Sarah has a lot of experience with and is close to her heart. We're moving into the season of spring, and it's a time when we see all of this imagery related to the earth's fertility and, you know, the eggs of Easter and the blossoming of cherry trees. And this can be a beautiful thing, but as we discussed back in our bittersweet spring episode a few years ago, spring can bring its anxiety too. And so thematically for people struggling with fertility anxiety, we see how this season could actually exacerbate that anxiety or heighten that anxiety. So we felt it was a good moment to talk about it. Cheryl, before I turn to Sarah and her story, is there anything that you would like to add here?
Just want to second everything you just said, Victoria, how delighted we are to have you here, Sarah. And again, we can't imagine anybody else. We've wanted to do this topic for a while, and we had scheduled with you at one point and had to reschedule, and there's just nobody else that we entrust. It is such a tender topic. It's so vulnerable. It can be so painful and scary and kind of highlights all of the areas that come to the fore when people are in an anxious spiral around vulnerability and lack of control and this desire that we have. I mean, if you are in the trying to conceive stage of life, then you are having a very strong desire to have a child. That doesn't mean that there's not also ambivalence, which I'm sure we will touch on. But it's so fraught with equal parts longing, desire, the deepest love that we feel even before we have a child, and then the terror and out of controlness and vulnerability and groundlessness that can come up. So we are just so pleased to be here with you, Sarah. And again, I will also attest to Sarah's incredible skills as a coach, as a witness and holder of space and creating transformational healing for so many people around this topic and many other sources of anxiety, whether it's relationship anxiety or health anxiety or just life itself. So thank you for being here, Sarah. We would love to start with you sharing as much of your story as you feel comfortable sharing around your own journey with fertility.
Thank you so much, Victoria and Cheryl. I'm so thrilled to be here. And so excited to share and a little nervous to share too. But I also feel just so lucky to be able to share this because I know that when I was going through my journey in trying to get pregnant and dealing with fertility anxiety, that I would have loved to have listened to a podcast on the subject because I know that it can feel like such an alone time. And even though your partner is going through it with you, I think it's hard for the person who is not carrying the child, right, to get it. And, you know, if we're speaking about a heterosexual relationship, I think it's usually the woman who is carrying that anxiety and that deeper sense of longing. Probably not exclusively. I know that was the case in my experience and has been the case with clients that I've worked with on this. So it can feel alone, even though, you know, you might have the most sensitive, most tender, most understanding partner. And I think we also can feel alone in it too, because I know I felt this way. And I think most people feel like it's not something that they feel like they can just share with their coworkers or people who aren't super close friends, and often struggle sharing with family members. I know it's something that I didn't share very much about with my family members because it felt just so vulnerable. Mm. Just felt, if I talk about this, I am going to just fall apart.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't something I wanted to bring up at Thanksgiving or Christmas or times where me and my sisters were able to get together. And I feel really lucky that, you know, I was working with Cheryl and that was a space where I could let it all just hang out. Mm. So my husband and I, we got married when I was 35 years old, which if you're a woman, 35 tends to be, if they're not going off already, when those inner alarm bells start going off, like, I got to get to it. Mm-hmm. If you have an inkling, right, or, you know, a quite clear longing that having a child is something you want to do. And, you know, we didn't want to start trying right away because we wanted, I was still struggling with some relationship anxiety stuff in the first 6 months of our marriage. And so we wanted to get, you know, firmer footing, right? And so we decided to start trying on our year anniversary. Of course, that was a huge failure. Let's put a ton of pressure. It's our first year anniversary, right? You know, let's put some extra pressure on ourselves, not just to have sex, but for this to be the sex that makes a baby. Mm. Right. And so I don't remember the particulars, but, you know, safe to say it wasn't the most romantic, playful sexual experience, which was, you know, the transition from having sex for just fun and as a way to connect and a way to be intimate with each other was really challenging. And being highly sensitive, being someone who likes to feel in control, you know, it was a real surrendering. So it was a real period of adjustment, you know. And the first month we had sex, what, you know, I thought was the right window of time, and it didn't happen. And, you know, I remember being disappointed and pretty like quickly going into fear. I didn't have the sense of faith of like, oh, well, like, yeah, it didn't happen this time, but it's going to happen in the next few months. I quickly went into, oh my God, it's, you know, it didn't happen. I'm 35. Like, this is going to be years of us trying to get pregnant. And it was kind of every month, making sure that we had sex, once, twice, trying three times, you know, there's a lot of pressure during that window of time. And then every month getting my period and just being so sad and just weeping and just feeling so out of control and broken and like there was something wrong with me and like I'd really massively screwed up waiting this long and just sure that it was never going to happen to me, like really going into all or nothing thinking like it hasn't happened this month, so it's never happening. And spending time with my young nieces and nephews, you know, while it could be really sweet, it could also be very painful. It was months and months of this. And along the way, I started to develop some tools, but it was never easy. It was never like, oh, I got it. Like, I'm totally great with uncertainty and like, like, and completely anchor into it's totally going to happen. And like, yeah, I don't know what I was so worried about. You know, like every month it was hard. And, you know, Brian and I would try to continue to live our lives. So it wasn't just all about this, right? And I think that that's so important. Travel is something that we have always loved to do together. And so we would kind of take some breaks. In a sense, kind of take the month off in the sense of like, well, like, you know, we'll try to have sex during the window, but if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. We're going to go on vacation. Like, we're going to enjoy ourselves. And that was helpful. Remembering your sense of fun and play is so important. Always, but particularly when you're going through challenging times. And then, so this had been like, you know, a year and a half. It's funny because I always thought it took us over 2 years to get pregnant. But recently I was going back through my journals and I realized it actually wasn't. It was roughly a year and a half that it took. So kind of the story of leading up to it was we had decided to take a trip to Peru together, to give ourselves a break, right? And to do something fun because we knew that, you know, once we had a kid, if goddess willing, we had a child, that probably a trip to Peru wouldn't be in the cards for, I don't know, at least 10 years. And it had been a place that was very much on our bucket list, going to Machu Picchu. And, you know, it was going to be both of our first time in South America. And so we planned this trip and we went. And I didn't really have any other expectations for the trip other than I thought it would be really cool to see Machu Picchu. And we're going to Lake Titicaca, where these indigenous people live on these floating islands in the middle of the lake at like 12,000 feet above sea level, and seeing the Andes. And I was excited about it because it seemed like going to another planet compared to where we live, which is right outside of New York City. And then, you know, when we got there and started exploring, I noticed that when we were going into Catholic cathedrals, because Catholicism is the main religion there, aside from the indigenous religion, that Mary was at the center in the cathedrals. It wasn't Jesus, right, on the cross like you typically see in American Catholic churches and European Catholic churches mostly as well. It was Mary. And she was also dressed in this gown that came out in a really, you can't see me because this is a podcast, but in this kind of triangle shape. So she looked like a mountain. And what we found out was that this was the marriage of the indigenous religion, because the indigenous Peruvians worshipped the Apus and Pachamama, as they called her, Mother Earth. And so it was Mother Mary and a mountain in one. And the combination of being in this majestic nature, seeing the Andes Mountains, being up at 12,000, I think the highest elevation we were at was 16,000 feet, really high, and seeing their version of Catholicism and Mary really spoke to me. I had been raised, my parents were what you might call evangelicals. It's how they met. And I grew up going to a Lutheran church. And then when I was a teenager, my parents got my mom got radically less conservative and moved us over to an Episcopalian church, which is sort of like, you might call it Catholic light. So I don't have the history with Catholicism, which I understand is problematic, rightfully so for a lot of people, but I was able to pull from the tradition that I saw in Peru and from the connection that I felt with Mother Nature, which I had always felt since I was a child, but living in, I live right outside of New York, I had gotten very disconnected from. And coming back from that trip, there was a spiritual shift that happened. And I came back with some souvenirs, my Pachamama right here, which is a statue of the Virgin, but not how you might see her in typical European cultures. She has butterfly wings, and she's coming out of a pot, and she's draped in this robe that is covered in flowers. And so coming back from that trip, I started to really anchor in her and talk to her. And I remember when I was trying to get pregnant, Mother's Day was always just the absolute worst. It was so, so hard. And we would always host my mother-in-law for Mother's Day, which I love doing. I love doing it, but it was also really challenging because it was about her and it wasn't about me at all. And I kind of had to put on a brave face and didn't feel like I could speak to, you know, the truth of what was going on with me about my longing and my sadness about becoming a mother. Anyway, we went to Peru in spring and got back. And interestingly, I went to an acupuncturist around that time. And I love acupuncture, but I went to a new acupuncturist who specialized in fertility. And the acupuncturist told me, oh no, you can't get pregnant as you are. You're like a Honda, and we need to get you to where you're a Ferrari. He's like, your chi isn't moving enough, right? And I remember leaving that appointment so devastated and really angry, and was not going back there again, but also like the damage had really been done. Like it was very, very traumatizing. I felt traumatized by it. And what's hilarious is that a couple of weeks later, on Mother's Day, I found out I was pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
So I was actually pregnant.
Oh my gosh. At that acupuncturist
appointment. And then on Mother's Day, I was feeling, I was a few days past my period, and my period's extremely regular. And I was feeling a little off, but you know, I had felt off like every single month. So I was like, well, you know, probably just going to be another sad Mother's Day for me. Mm-hmm. And then I took a pregnancy test and I was pregnant. Mm. And my first emotion was like, oh, I was so excited. And I have my journal entry from that day, May 9th. Just got a positive pregnancy test. Can't believe it. Totally in shock. Mm-hmm. Feeling a mix of emotions, happy, anxious, scared, light, excited, grateful. It's so hard to put this into words because I thought this moment would never come. And then immediately I go to, I'm also scared that something will happen. If I truly am pregnant, that's such a hard concept to wrap my brain around. What an amazing Mother's Day gift. Thank you, little baby, for agreeing to be a part of this family. I promise to love and cherish you and do the absolute best job I can to mother you. Please, dear Pachamama, dear God, give me and Brian guidance and love. Mm. Right. So I had all this excitement, but really quickly, fear came in around losing the baby. It's like, now I'm pregnant, but I know miscarriages are super common. And I went really quickly into fear, just intense fear of loss. And I remember, Cheryl, that we met and you said, Sarah, can you get into nature? Mm. And so my husband and I went on a hike. And I remember being on that hike and just feeling the earth beneath me and just being able to ground into and trusting that it was all going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And it was. It was. I know it isn't always, right? I know that miscarriages happen and they're so hard. So hard. But in this instance in our story, like, that wasn't the case. And 9 months later, we gave birth to a very healthy baby boy who has been just the light of our lives. And I've said this to Brian, I've said this to clients who are struggling with fertility anxiety, that if we had conceived that first month or any other month in that span of time, which felt like forever, mm-hmm. that it wouldn't have been our Sammy. Mm-hmm. It would have been someone else. And I know that that baby would have been awesome and we would have loved that baby just as much as we love Sammy, but I cannot imagine it not being Sammy, right? And I'm so grateful that it took the time that it did.
There are so many elements to that story that are so beautiful and so vulnerable and tender. So thank you for sharing that story and sharing it so well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Sammy is how old now? How long ago?
He's 7 now.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's 7. He was born in 2017, beginning of 2017.
And how old were you when?
And so I was 38 when I gave birth, and I turned 39 just a couple months later.
Mm-hmm. So going back to those 18 months or so, where every month is devastating, right? Every time you get your period, it's just devastating. And going through the grief and the fear and the groundlessness and the doubt every single time. What were some of the tools. You said that you sort of gathered some tools along the way that helped to accompany the challenge.
Yeah. So I think one is making room for the grief. Like, we can't just push it away and ignore it or deny it or say, oh, like, well, I shouldn't be feeling this way. Right? We have to allow ourselves the space to grieve it, right? You know, it feels like a loss every month. Mm-hmm. And so that's real. We've got to meet it and hopefully have someone to witness it with us in a compassionate way. For me, a tool that is a daily tool still is journaling. And so journaling my feelings, getting connected to my wise self, and exercising that muscle, and it really is a muscle. The more that you have a consistent habit of connecting with your own inner wisdom, highest self, God, goddess, whatever you choose to call it, the more that is available to you. So it doesn't make it easy. It's not like, you know, taking a pill, but it is, it's that support. It's that grounding. And it's like, in addition to having other people hold and witness you, that you can be, you can witness it and hold it for yourself. Because it's too big, right? It's too big for a partner to hold all of it. It's too big for a therapist to hold all of it, right? There needs to be a connection with one's own faith or inner guidance or both in order to navigate through it. I am someone, I love to be in control. You know, I'm the driver, the car driver in me and my husband's relationship, because I like to be in control, right? I like to be in control of when we get there and how we get there, right? And this process is very much a process of giving over control and making room for mystery and trust. And so having a prayer practice, whatever that looks like for you, I think is so important. Something that was also super helpful for me during the time is I've studied Reiki, right? And so I am what is known as a Reiki master, even though I don't care for that term so much. But so I've had a regular Reiki practice that is really a practice of rest and of gentle touch on your own body and of connecting with life force energy to heal and to ground and to connect with something larger. Right. So that was another way that I was consistently connecting with something greater than my small fear mind, which would have gladly completely taken over.
Yes. Yes. And speaking of fear, I'm wondering if you can speak to, we live in a very fear-based culture around fertility. Especially past a certain age. And I would say there is that 35 marker where you are then termed a geriatric pregnancy, which is just a horrifically horrendous term to put on a 35-year-old or a 40-year-old.
It's crazy.
But I think in Victoria, you can probably speak to this. I think it starts much earlier, the fear around, have I waited too long? Oh my God, I'm 30. I'm already 30. And I've missed the boat somehow. And I see people in my circle having babies in their 20s and 29. And but now I'm 32 and I still don't, I'm still don't even feel close to. So there's this fear that is entrenched in our culture around fertility. So that what I see, and no judgment, everybody has to go on their own path, but there is a big push that if you don't get pregnant within a few months, to go see a fertility specialist and have everything checked. And that's fine if that's your path, but I'm just curious from your path and your story, Sarah. I know that you, I mean, maybe you had had levels checked. I don't remember, but you didn't do any kind of serious interventions.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, if it had taken probably much longer, we probably would have. And yes, I can note the biological clock started going, you know, definitely when I hit 30. But when I was 30, Brian and I had just started dating. Right? So it was kind of like, well, you know, I am risk adverse and cautious, so I'm not going to jump into marriage super quickly, right? And so like that was kind of like background noise, right? It was like, yeah, I know. And I have three younger sisters. They all had children before me. I'm the oldest in my family. In some ways, I think it was lucky because living in New York City, a lot of my friends and just people around, like it's not abnormal or out of the ordinary at all to like start trying to have your first kid at 40, right? So that was something that like was in my immediate surroundings. Like I knew that I wasn't going to be an outlier, right, in my community, which I think did make it easier in some sense. And, you know, when I became pregnant, I was I went to see an OBGYN who was very highly rated. Like he wanted to do like all these tests right away. And it was like, it just felt so much and like so much fear. And I was like, mm-hmm. I don't want this. I mm-hmm. have enough of my own fear. I don't need someone else feeding me yes. fear every time mm-hmm. I'm in the office. Mm-hmm. And so I switched out of that practice right away. And I'm really glad I did. I switched to a midwifery practice where I was able to give birth in a hospital, but then you know, we can talk about my birth story another episode, but because that was its whole other thing. But I'm really glad that I switched into a practice that, you know, she was like, oh no, because I interviewed them. She's like, oh no, we see people, you know, in their 40s having children. There's nothing, you're fine. And it was like, okay, yep, this sign me up. Like yes. I'm in the right place.
And I think it's such an important piece in terms of going to where you feel comforted and reassured mm-hmm. and that there's a belief in your capacity to conceive versus places where you are surrounded by a fear-based mindset. And that it's sometimes hard to differentiate because no one's outwardly saying, I'm coming from fear, but it's how you feel in your body. Do you feel like the acupuncturist where you said, never again. And what a great story because you were literally pregnant at the moment when he's telling you, you can't get pregnant as you are. So
and it's like, yeah, you can't get pregnant because you are pregnant.
Well, just goes to show, you know, you could have outsourced self-trust at that moment and bought into his conviction. Because it's very easy to do that mm-hmm. when someone's in the power position and we're going with all of our fear and our uncertainty and someone says something with such certainty, but you didn't. You harnessed your self-trust and you trusted your body and you said, no, to that environment, someone literally telling me you will not get pregnant as you are. But similarly, with the earlier OBGYN saying this is not an environment that feels life-affirming, that feels that it is in alignment with the belief that I can conceive. And so I think just as a general, for anybody listening who's trying to conceive, it's a really important barometer and metric, right? Is where do you feel fear? Where do you feel supported, right? Where do you feel doubt? Where do you feel some sense of trust? And not in the sense of, and this is where we have to be very careful in our belief that, oh, if I go to the life-affirming places, then I'll get pregnant. So it's like this tricky way that we're still trying to control, because there's also that message in maybe not the mainstream, but in the sort of new age world of all you have to do is be in perfect harmony and don't feel scared and don't be ambivalent and don't have any doubt, because then you're going to shut down all your chance. And it's like, well, no, it's actually so much bigger than all of that. So it's not we go to the life-affirming places so that we'll get pregnant. It's so that as we are going through this process, whatever the process is, right now we're talking about trying to conceive, but this applies to everything in life, that we surround ourselves externally and internally with as many of those places of trust, you know, and belief, positive belief as we can.
And as a reminder to everyone out there who might be trying to conceive or in the very early stages of pregnancy, you being scared does not determine the outcome. Yes. You can get pregnant when you're anxious. You can stay pregnant when you're anxious.
Yes.
And you being anxious during your pregnancy or while you're trying to conceive does not mean that your child is going to be an anxious, colicky baby. They may be, but has no bearing on your own internal state. There are much, much, much larger forces at work.
Yes. Yes.
This conversation feels so tender and vulnerable because we are deeply aware that not everybody does get pregnant.
Right. And your story ended so
yeah.
well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not every pregnancy does go the way that people hope, that, as Sarah said, miscarriage is very common and that this whole process is incredibly mysterious and vulnerable and we don't actually have control over it. So I think the challenge of this conversation is holding a multitude of experiences. We are really speaking to this place of trying to get pregnant and having anxiety about will it ever happen. And in Sarah's story, it did happen, and that's so beautiful. And we are so aware that that is not everyone's story, and it does yes. not mean that it's because they did something wrong or because they are less of a woman or there's something fundamentally broken about their body.
Or their faith wasn't strong enough.
Yes.
Or like they weren't. Or that they were too anxious or, you yes. know, like all these things.
And I'm also aware that right now, like in the news, we've been hearing about people in Alabama who have been using IVF services. I just visited my friend whose baby, she had her baby in a little onesie that said, made with a lot of love and a little science.
Mm-hmm. Oh, love that.
She and her partner used IVF. They have this beautiful baby, and in our country, in one of the states in our country, people are scrambling to figure out what a state court ruling around IVF means for their journey with fertility. When I think about fertility anxiety living in this country right now, I mean, that just
enhances the anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. And yes. And yes, there are so many different ways that this can look for people. Sometimes, you know, science comes along and helps to make this happen. Mm-hmm. I love what you shared, Sarah, about both the first OBGYN you went to and the acupuncturist, because I think so much damage can be done by people. It does not matter whether they are rooted totally in like science and research or rooted in like spirituality and holistic healing. Mm-hmm. It's about the person and their, I don't know, their general way of being and how they wield their tools. Any of those tools can be beautiful and life-giving, or they can be so destructive and damaging.
Yeah.
And I like that you were able to speak to that for us, that it's not, I think when we are so afraid and we're looking for something to hold on to, we can grasp and we're so vulnerable to a message like that of like, you're a Honda?
Yeah.
Excuse me? And having been someone who's had gynecological issues and had such a hard time in doctor's offices at times, like feeling so helpless and vulnerable and judged. And I wasn't even in the process of thinking about my fertility at all, but just mm-hmm. my body and this intimate part of my body. I just know how much sitting in certain offices, sitting with certain people can just add to that anxiety. So thank you for speaking to that as well.
Yeah. So I think for anyone trying to conceive, it's so easy to hand our self-trust over to a doctor, right? Or an acupuncturist or a psychic, or, you know, it's just so mm-hmm. easy when we want something so badly to happen, to be like, you tell me how to do it. Like, I'm completely in your hands because I feel so out of control and lost. And I think that's especially true of people who are highly sensitive. We tend to have such respect for authority and for people who are in positions of power that I think it's even easier for us to just hand it over. And how dangerous that can be, how damaging it can be, especially when we're in such a vulnerable place.
Mm-hmm. What's really funny about that story about the acupuncturist is I thought you were going to say, you're a Honda, but we need you to be like a bicycle or a horse-drawn carriage. And he went the other way of like, you need to be this
sophisticated, even yeah. more finely
and
tuned.
Faster. And,
yeah.
You know, because I think in that process of trying to conceive, we can jump. He was speaking to, I think, a very dangerous mindset of I have to do more and I have to be better and I have to be more sleek in some way and more polished. And actually, so much of the work in that process is, as we keep saying, is about letting go and doing less. Yes, do the things you know you need to do and take care of your body and have sex in the window. But other than that, it is out of your hands. And so for him to say that just goes right into that belief.
Yeah, it goes right into, it plays right into that perfectionist mindset that people who are highly sensitive so often get caught up in, is that I have to be perfect. I have to eat perfectly. I have to exercise perfectly. I have to do everything perfectly.
Like, yes, you know, my mind has to be perfect and my mental state.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. My spirituality has to be perfect. It all has to be perfect. And it's just not true. It's just not true. You know, and I used to remind myself, you know, that people get pregnant all the time who, you know, drink a liter of Coke a day or, you know, like.
Or worse.
Smoke or, you know, do all kinds of things. And like, you know, and that what I'm doing, I'm a fairly healthy person, right? It is enough.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm imagining that for someone who has ambivalence about becoming a parent, becoming a mother, that the anxiety around fertility, about actually getting pregnant, could like channel all of your anxiety into like, I just need to get pregnant at this point. Once you've, right? Like once you've made the decision, well, I'm going to try, then you could funnel all the anxiety into, I just need to make this happen now. I don't know if you had any ambivalence about becoming a parent by that point, but maybe even in people you work with, if you've seen this, I'm just curious if any other fears came up once you actually were pregnant. Like, then was there an opening for more anxiety around actually being a parent? Or, you know, did you have ambivalence at the same time as you were trying to get pregnant? Or is that something that you see in people that you work with?
It's something that I see a lot in people who I work with, is ambivalence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was someone who struggled with ambivalence around marriage. I both like really wanting to get married, but also scared of getting married, right? Mm-hmm. But I often see it with people who are highly sensitive, who, you know, they get to that place where they're like 75%, 80% sure. And I think it's important to say that you don't have to have complete and total 100% sureness, clarity around this or any other topic that you might struggle with anxiety around. Because as highly sensitive people, doubt often accompanies our journey. And that that's okay. And I think that that's actually really normal. The difference between someone who's, you know, on the sensitive anxious spectrum versus someone who maybe isn't, is the amount of importance that they put onto those thoughts, right? Mm. You know, someone who is less sensitive may be like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I want to have a kid, so we're going to try, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas someone who is on the sensitive anxious spectrum, it's like, well, I'm pretty sure, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm not sure if we should start trying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? And then with those people that I've worked with, you know, it's funny because oftentimes they'll get pregnant really quickly. you know, who knows why, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not exclusively the case, right? But you know, it definitely has been the case. And then it's like, it's okay to carry that ambivalence with you as you're pregnant. I mean, there's a reason I think that we're pregnant for 9 months, right? So that we can do the inner work of getting used to the idea of becoming a mother. I mean, it's a very transformational physically process, mm-hmm. right? And there's also a lot of transformation, of course, happening on the inside as well. And I remember I didn't have intense anxiety while I was pregnant, but yeah, there were a lot of things that came up. There, you know, fears came up around, oh my God, like, how are we going to pay for this baby?
You know? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
You know, the slow kind of realization of, wow, our lives are going to radically shift. Mm-hmm. We were living in a one-bedroom, 550-square-foot apartment. And it was like, well, I guess we're going to be living in this apartment with this baby. And we'll see how that is. But, you know, being, you know, having some worry and fear about how that would be. And it was all fine, mm-hmm. by the way. It was all fine. But, yes, I think a trap is that, you know, we have to be that sure that we are 100% ready economically, physically, spiritually, emotionally, in all the ways. It's another way that perfectionism shows up. And it's like, just there, if you wait until then you're just never going to take the leap.
Yeah. I don't know how much you want to speak to this, Sarah, because it's more Brian's story, but a couple of things come to mind. I know by the time you were ready to try to conceive, you were not ambivalent, but he was.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if, you know, if you feel comfortable speaking to that at all. And also, I don't think this came up too much for you, but for a lot of people, there can be a very short leap from we are having a hard time conceiving or it's taking longer than we were hoping and relationship anxiety. Mm-hmm. If I was with somebody else, yeah, it wouldn't be taking, or this is evidence that I'm with the wrong partner. Because if I was mm-hmm. with the right partner, we would have gotten pregnant already.
Yeah. Brian's ambivalence was hard. It's hard when, you know, one person is so clearly a yes and the other person is like, okay.
I could go either way.
Yeah, I can go either way. It's, you know, and at the same time, I was aware because I know how I am and I know how I was during relationship anxiety that my certainty, right, allows for his ambivalence, right? And if I was ambivalent, he would likely be occupying the certain space,
mm-hmm.
right? And so just even having that cognitive understanding made yes. it easier to hold. And also understanding how my husband goes through transitions too, right? Which I have had now many opportunities to understand that that's part of how he goes through transitions, right? And now that Brian is a father, like you would not find a more devoted, excited, loving dad. And I knew that. I absolutely knew that. I also understood that his ambivalence was coming from a fear of loss, that he didn't mm-hmm. want to go through the pain of seeing a child grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm married to a real softy.
Mm-hmm. Also a sensitive.
Yes. Also mm-hmm. a sensitive man. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's funny being married to someone else who's very sensitive. Like, I don't always have the most sensitivity for their sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right? And that's something, you know, I've got to check with myself and work on myself with. So my own need for certainty isn't just blasting past my partner's need to go through the transition in his own way. And yes, relationship anxiety. So I remember relationship anxiety coming up. I remember having those thoughts of, if I was with someone else, this would be easier. But, you know, as you both know, I had been through it with relationship anxiety. And I was like, I am not going back there.
Mm-hmm.
I am not indulging in those thoughts. You know, what we water will grow, right? As you say, Cheryl. And I was like, I'm just not watering them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Beautiful. You made a very clear conscious choice
yeah.
about what thoughts you were going to indulge. You could hear the relationship anxiety piping up.
Yeah.
You know, attempting escape hatch to yep. relieve you from your anxiety and vulnerability and fear and grief, but nope, not going there. I am not going back there ever again in any kind of
yeah.
real way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to indulge it.
Yeah.
I will grieve with you, right? I will hold you in your grief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can be anxious about, you know, all the uncertainty and all that, mm-hmm. but we're not going back to that storyline.
Yeah.
There's like, we've exhausted that storyline. I know I have a really good, solid partner who's going to be a great dad. Like,
that's all you need to know.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Is there anything you can speak to? Because I know this comes up a lot for people who are trying month after month, the feeling that sex is now a chore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a hard one.
Mm.
I mean, it's hard. My husband and I were really lucky in that sex is a place where we have always really connected. And so when it shifted from that to about, let's get it done, right? And this kind of like, it's go time, right? But that was challenging. I think what helped, and it's not easy, right? But is not just having sex in that window. Mm-hmm. So having sex at other times in the month so that you're not, so that it doesn't just feel like this is a job and a chore. Also, I think taking breaks helped. And this is something that I don't think just relates to trying to conceive, but I think it kind of starts with trying to conceive, that sex starts becoming more like a job, and then you have the baby and the kind of sex kind of still feels like a job sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what has helped is as much as you can bringing play into your lives, to remembering to play together, right? And, you know, that's going to look different for every couple, right? But to remember why you love each other and what connected mm-hmm. you to one another in the first place. Mm-hmm. And to continue to do those things that brought you together. I think I remember feeling very often like the trying to have a baby was like the sole project that we were working on, and it was all encompassing. Right? And there's nothing less joyless, nothing more joyless than that. Right. And so remembering to play and to not be so myopic in where you are in your lives that it becomes just the only thing that you're either reading about, talking about, or doing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I will say, before I ask my closing question, that this could go on for hours, and we're really just opening a conversation and sharing one story, your story, Sarah, some tools that you've learned along the way that hopefully will be helpful to others listening. It's one of those topics, Victoria, we talk about, like there's certain topics that are just so vast that it's hard to know where to focus. And so I think focusing on one person's story is a great entry point. But I think it's also important to say, as we've said, this is just one story. There are common themes in the journey of trying to conceive how whatever the final outcome is. And there are so many different routes to that, to being pregnant these days, all of which can be just miraculous and incredible to go down those paths, that those, if those are available to you. And so I think to just name that we're in one of those realms, right? We're in one of those topics. Like we once tried to do an episode on friendship and we were like, blah.
we're still trying to find the road we're with still that trying one 3 years later. We're like, oh yeah, friendship.
Yeah, just that little thing, you know, that's like people experience it in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Which is the hard thing about a topic like friendship and a hard thing about a topic like trying to conceive, that there are common threads, and then there are as many stories as there are people trying to conceive. Mm-hmm. And so we recognize our deficiency, you know, in trying to tackle this and offer it. I'm wondering, Sarah, if there's just anything, if you're imagining somebody sitting in front of you who has been trying to conceive for quite some time, and they are in the depths of their grief and fear and really having a hard time trusting in whatever the outcome will be, if there's anything that you might want to say to that person.
The first thing I would say is, I see you, and your grief is real. Mm-hmm. and it being hard is real. And I know that we don't really get a chance to talk about it in our culture. It's not considered just like casual conversation. Hey, I'm having a really hard time conceiving. It's just not, what we do.
Yeah.
And I hope that we can move to a place where perhaps there are spaces where we can talk more freely about it. Because I think that that would be really healing.
Mm.
And if I was going to give like just one suggestion, and that is to find your place where you feel close to spirit, God, the universe, whatever you would like to call it. For me, that place is nature,
mm-hmm.
right, most clearly. But what is that place for you? And to spend time every day consistently doesn't have to be a lot of time. I always say it's just much more about consistency than it is about quantity. But spending consistent time in communion with wherever that special place or that special connection is, and listening not to the voice of fear, right, but opening up to the voice of your ancestors, or to the voice of God or Mary or Vishnu, Pachamama, Gaia, what God by any name, right, your own highest self.
The trees, the water, the trees, the grass.
Yes, all of it. Mm-hmm. Yes. And just listening for what you hear.
Yeah. Mm. It's beautiful.
Amen. Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was incredibly special for me, and I hope it feels helps at least one person feel less alone in their journey.
Yes.
Yes. And I will say, Sarah, you were a guest on my show, on my podcast Perennials a few years ago, and we talked about relationship anxiety in that episode. And I think about that conversation that you and I had like regularly. So if anyone wants to hear more about Sarah's thoughts on relationship anxiety and true love, that was the name of the episode, True Love with Sarah Kestner. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, because you, as people have heard in this episode, you just have so much wisdom and compassion to share. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Victoria. I love doing that podcast episode with you. And I love you both. You're both just amazing humans. And I'm so lucky, so blessed to know you both.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Jarrett Farkas for the use of our beautiful new theme music. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe or follow, leave us a review, share it with a friend, and consider joining our Patreon, where we share regular bonus content and also host virtual meetups. Visit patreon.com/gatheringgold to learn more.